A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
I'm not ranting and raving. I'm just telling you. You know, you're dishonest people.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
You are fake news.
The media is a frequent target of President Trump. This week, the press fought back. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, why a free press and an independent media is so important in a modern democracy. More than 300 newspapers across the country published editorials this week promoting freedom of the press and denouncing the president's frequent attacks on the media. That included the Kansas City Star, the Topeka Capital Journal, and the Lawrence Journal World. The effort was spearheaded by the Boston Globe, which said, quote, "The greatness of America is dependent on the role of a free press to speak the truth to the powerful," and called labeling the press the enemy of the people un-American and dangerous. At the center of the controversy is the group of reporters that cover the president on a daily basis. The White House Correspondents Association raised a red flag about President Trump's attacks on the media earlier this year and held a series of events across the country to promote the role of the press in America today. The first of those events was held February 19, 2018, at the Truman Presidential Library and Institute in Independence, Missouri. It featured four journalists that have covered several presidencies and presidential campaigns. We'll hear from Major Garrett, chief White House correspondent for CBS News, Zeke Miller, White House correspondent for the Associated Press, Margaret Talev, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, and then president of the White House Correspondents Association. We'll also hear from Dr. Betty Winfield, who specializes in political communication and mass media history. But first, Karen Ball, former White House correspondent for the New York Daily News.
I was fortunate enough to work for the Associated Press and cover the 92 campaign from early in that year. And at first, there were all of the candidates, Jerry Brown, Bob Kerry, Paul Tsongas. And then when it became clear that Clinton was going to get the nomination, I was just what they called, you know, the lead AP person, which meant I basically would come home, grab a fresh set of clothes from the dry cleaner, and then just go back to the plane again. And one of the striking things about today's White House and campaign reporters and how blessed we were at the time, we had extraordinary access that reporters on the Trump campaign certainly, and I suppose Hillary's campaign just as bad. It was a long time before she let reporters join her plane, or they added a plane. When I covered Clinton on the campaign, I mean, the only thing that separated us between, meaning the reporters between Bill Clinton and his inner circle, was a little kitchen galley. And he frequently came to the back of the plane to talk to us. And it would not be unusual, you know, for the plane to be rocking, and he would just bump right into whoever was next to him. And you know, I, in fact, was lucky enough to, at times, be called up front because Clinton wanted to play hearts and they needed a fourth hand, or they needed two hands, and David Marinus also went up occasionally, and I don't know if we were just two people who knew how to play hearts or whatever, but, you know, there was extraordinary access. And also, I feel very lucky that it was a time when I think the majority of Americans clearly felt like the press corps was a very important part of democracy. And, you know, when we rolled into big campaign events, people would look at us, maybe not quite with awe, but we certainly felt glamorous and as though, you know, we were respected. And I do feel for the current press corps that that they have much maligned, and it seems very unfair to me because, you know, these are people just doing their jobs and trying to bring, you know, sunshine to what's going on. And Clinton, I think, also, I think it was kind of a turning point in many ways in that that campaign and then the White House coverage became, it was a turning point in terms of, you know, faster, uglier, more chaotic. Clinton, I mean, he can't really hold a candle now to the 24/7 stuff that's going on. But Clinton did love to go from 5 in the morning until 2 in the morning. And you know, I believe that they were the first campaign to use the phrase war room in terms of, you know, having a rapid response team, people on the ground ready to come right back with attacks. And you started hearing, you know, there was a more coarsening of the culture that I think obviously we've seen just get worse and worse and worse. You know, anywhere between, you know, Mary Madeline calling Clinton a fat, draft-dodging, dope-smoking adulterer to Carville a couple of years later, you know, saying, look what happens when you drag $20 through a trailer park. They started to be a free-for-all in that sense. We had extraordinary access. As the AP person, not because of me, but because I represented the wire service, I was with Clinton all the time, and I would be almost as if I were a Secret Service agent and holding my tape recorder on every rope line. And he loved to dive into the crowd. And so we wanted every bit of information we got from him. And in fact, there were times late at night on the plane when he would start to come back and we would almost say, please, no more. We've had enough of your words today. We've talked too much already. So I sit at home and I watch the campaign and political coverage, and sometimes I have I miss it so much, but it really does look so different. I'm not sure I would be cut out for it in these days.
So I think this is a great segue, Major, if you can take us a little bit to today, because in some ways those days are gone, and in some ways those days are very much alive. They're just expressed a little bit differently.
Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm delighted to be here. This is kind of a full circle moment for me, because when I was 18 years old, driving with my mother from my hometown in San Diego to my freshman year at the University of Missouri, along the way we stopped here at this library. It was the first presidential library I ever toured. I've never forgotten it. I'm very deeply proud to be here, honored to be asked to join this panel. Just to contrast what Karen said about the access to Bill Clinton during the 92 campaign, Donald Trump flew in his own plane. No reporters were ever on that plane.
Trump Force One
is what he called it. And the crowds loved it, and the plane was its own banner for the campaign. But reporters were never on that. We flew in a separate plane, and not only was Trump not on the plane that we were on, nobody from his campaign was on the plane we were on. So if you had a question to ask anyone attached to the campaign, and you were on the press plane, there was no one to speak to except via text or email or some other form. You could not have any interaction with any senior member of the Trump campaign under any circumstance during the course of a campaign, which is really without precedent in the modern American presidential history. That arm's length relationship carried out through the entire campaign, and I can tell you, having attended more than 70 Trump rallies around the country over the course of 16 months, when we walked in, I guarantee you we were not looked upon with awe. There might have been an A word involved, but it wasn't awe. And I'll just leave it at that. But one thing I do want to say before I sort of leap into the Trump part of the conversation, look, every American president has, through one means or another, attempted to tell the press that they're covering him unfairly, push back against what they consider to be excessively nosy coverage of the presidency, or try to find a way to work around the established Washington press corps. Abraham Lincoln, for example, would send letters up from his desk to favored newspapers around the country, letters from the president. They were public letters in which he would announce a policy or an idea to go around the coverage of the White House reporters covering him. A public letter published exactly the way Lincoln wanted them in his favorite papers. A modern equivalent of a tweet, if you would be willing to indulge me in that metaphor. Herbert Hoover was so upset about the coverage he received from the White House press corps, he once wrote a statement that said, "No paper in America should publish anything about the White House other than an official documented statement. That didn't work, but he did it anyway. Okay. It is not new for presidents to try to go around, over, or through the White House press corps. That is not a new phenomenon. And it's not a new phenomenon for the American presidency to use whatever technology was available to them to achieve that goal, whether it was FDR on the radio, President Kennedy with television, Bill Clinton with a rapid response in 1992, which they brought into the White House. The war room of the campaign became the war room for many of the domestic policy initiatives of the Clinton administration. Barack Obama, oftentimes when I covered him as president, would use social media to announce policy initiatives. I'll never forget when he did a Facebook video to announce a significant change in his immigration policy. He did that aboard Air Force One, bringing a taxpayer-funded videographer into his conference room to videotape his announcement, which was then sent out by the White House while he's in the air, and nobody in the White House press corps had any inkling this was happening at all. I mean, it was a complete leaping over of the entrenched White House press corps because he didn't want to have to answer any pesky questions we might have about the underlying policy. So I just want to say that as a predicate, that so much of what President Trump represents feels so different and feels so out of our normal experience, and it is, but not all of it is. Now, here are the things that are. First of all, the White House press office is not organized around the concept of engaging reporters or providing information beyond what the president says. If you routinely ask people in lower press or the upper press, the whole shop, what are some of the underlying facts, figures, very hard to come by, very hard to get from them because they're not really organized around the idea that informing the White House press corps is a particularly high priority for this president. And oftentimes, the White House spokespeople simply refer to what the president has said on Twitter or what he said in speeches, and that's it. And the White House press briefings have a kind of metronomic quality, like three or four talking points, and they just sort of go back and forth and back and forth, and no matter how many different ways we ask the question or come at it from different angles, this metronomic set of answers, three or four of them, and that's really the extent of the press briefing. Press briefings have shrunk from about an hour and 10 minutes, to maybe 22 or 23 minutes. They are very short, very compressed. And they're built entirely around the communication strategy of the president, which most of the country interacts with through occasional set piece speeches, but mostly via Twitter, which is just a radical concept for a president communicating not only to the country, but to the world. And it is an exhausting aspect of covering this presidency. It just flat out is exhausting. Because once it was declared by Sean Spicer, once press secretary for the President of the United States, that everything Donald Trump says on Twitter is an official presidential statement, everything has to be weighed and measured and sifted as a presidential statement. The consequential to the inane and everything in between. And that's a big continuum with President Trump, a very big continuum. And it's very difficult as a White House reporter to, especially one who's been hamstrung as I have by covering four previous presidents, to get into that rhythm. Because A, there is no rhythm, there is no predictability, and it's very difficult for news desks and reporters to weigh the relative weight of each and every tweet. Is it simply a quote of clarion call and a political matter to his base? Is it a serious policy statement? Is it something he's going to follow up on? Or is it something that's just sort of out there for the sake of being out there? Let me give you a classic example. So I'm working on a book about the first year of the Trump presidency, and one of the more fascinating stories is all the deliberations that went on inside the White House about transgender policy, because there was a significant debate in the Republican majority Congress about whether or not the federal government should pay through the military for those who wanted to transition while they were in the military. And the president was presented a range of options, and he got tired of waiting to sift through the options and just sent out a tweet: if you're transgender, you can't join the military, and those who are in have to go out. Do you remember that tweet? Okay, that was not only a thunderclap for those of us who were covering the Trump White House, it was a thunderclap for the Chief of Staff, the Defense Secretary, every lawyer at the Pentagon, and everyone in the White House counsel's office. They had no idea this was coming. None. And then they had to respond to a tweet after having just been in meetings with the President of the United States themselves about this policy. So anything that comes across Twitter can, in an instant, theoretically, fundamentally change American policy. That is completely different. And it makes the job, which is not only built around presidential travel, briefings, presidential speeches, statements, and all the other things, all the normal contours, so fundamentally different.
So we've gone from Clinton to Trump. But let's go back even a little bit further. This is all FDR's fault, right?
Right.
And yet, if President Donald Trump were a presidential scholar, I do think he would be interested in some of the ways that FDR dealt with the press and managed his public persona. And I'm wondering, Betty, before we get into tweets, Google, and all modern technology and everything that, thank God for Zeke, none of the rest of us understands in this room, let's talk a little bit about how FDR would see Donald Trump.
As FDR would say, that's an iffy question.
Right.
I don't answer iffy questions. FDR came in, and people thought maybe that there would not be any press conferences at all because they had become moribund during the 20s, and down to the point that they had written questions submitted ahead of time, and then to the president, from Harding, from Coolidge to Hoover. And one time the press got together and they all submitted the same question to Coolidge, and because they wanted to be sure this question was answered. And he thumbed through each of the cards and he didn't answer it. He said, okay, that's it. So, I mean, there was a discussion in 32 after the election whether or not there would even be any interaction between the presidents and the press. But you've got a very different president who came in then. First of all, a very different personality. That makes a difference. And we had tremendous crisis. I mean, if you ever talk to your grandparents or your parents, it was a horrible time in this country with the Great Depression. And so something had to be done. And in fact, 4 days after FDR was inaugurated, he had a press conference. And what he said, and I find this is an interesting situation now, he talked about the role of truth. I mean, think about that. I mean, that's really important in any time you cover a political figure, a president, the role of truth, how important that is. And so Roosevelt mentioned that in the inauguration. He said, this is preeminently the time to speak the truth. Remember, the banks were closed. It was horrible. Okay, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. And that's what he saw the press conferences as being, a way to get accurate information out. And so they were background sessions. They weren't televised. We did have the glimmers of television coming in, but they weren't radio broadcast. They were just background sessions for the journalist. And they were helping them to make sense of all the new agencies that were formed, all the new programs that were being discussed. And interesting enough, unlike today, or unlike previous presidents, the various heads of agencies would argue publicly. They had press conferences too. And they would argue about them. So the public was involved in the discussion by the arguments from Hopkins or from Ickes. And so they would discuss the positive and negatives of various programs. So this happened until World War II. And then in World War II, the government needed to speak in one voice. And that changed the press relations a lot. And it changed it to not having that multitude of voices coming out of the government. And so, in fact, Roosevelt and Truman became very angry when there were dissents among various cabinet members in public. Truman actually even fired Wallace because he and Barnes were arguing about the Soviet Union. And so you cannot, it makes a different time. And I think you need to think about that with Roosevelt and the press. He found it very useful. He found it very useful to talk to the journalists. The journalists were different then, too. The journalists not only were just spot news coverage that they had, they represented different newspapers around the country, but there were many correspondents that were there, too. This is a highlight, the golden age of correspondents. And so many of them not only covered as a reporter or a correspondent, but they also had a column. And so interpretive journalism really came into forth in the 1930s and 40s. And you needed it in one sense. Well, how do you explain the CCC? How do you explain, these various agencies, AAA or whatever? You needed some way to interpret it. So when you think about political coverage, it's not really what happens, but what is thought about it, what it will do, what will the programs do, and so forth. So those press conferences, his background sessions, would actually became very helpful in fitting in interpretive journalism, which Roosevelt hated. He talked about it in press conferences. Didn't like them going off on their own necessarily to interpret. But it was a given. It was just a given in the 30s and 40s. Unlike what we heard earlier about access, and certainly with Clinton as opposed to Trump, I mean, he did provide access. Not only did he provide access, he set a tone so that other cabinet members and other members of the agencies all had press conferences. They all met with the press. They all were able to answer questions. And in fact, in these various sessions and press conferences, sometimes you would hear information that weren't useful to you in covering here in Missouri, or being from Missouri, but might be useful to your buddy who's covering from Arizona or some other state because of plans. So it was like a way to share information too because of them. It's a form of news management too. Don't forget, this is a form of news management. Providing access, rewarding by providing access, and giving direct channels for particular viewpoints. And some of the techniques that Roosevelt used actually are used by Trump. In other words, when Roosevelt, something awful was going on, or he knew they were going to really hit him on it, for instance, the Supreme Court packing bill that went down to failure, he changed the subject. They came in and he made an announcement about something else to distract them. These tweets, don't forget, are distractive techniques also. They set a new agenda, something new to talk about. So,
They work.
They you're absolutely right, they do work. So there's a balance here that takes place in our democracy between government controls and management, and then what we, the public, need to judge leadership. What we must have to see whether somebody's doing a good job or not, or whether it can help us in voting, can help us have confidence in the government, and help us make decisions ourselves.
Because by virtue of the fact that we are wire services, Zeke and I travel a lot on Air Force One, and we are in the pool a lot, which is the group of reduced footprint of reporters who might go into the Oval Office or something like that when the full press corps can't be accommodated. So we've been talking about the differences in access, and certainly there are many differences. But lest anyone not already know this, it's not like there's no access to President Trump, like literally day to day or hour to hour. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that's different from Obama, and maybe even different from our expectations, since, as Major pointed out, there were no reporters on his actual plane when he was the candidate or the nominee, and some uncertainty about whether they would try to blow up that model once he took office. And to my mind, he realized very quickly what the benefit of keeping the press inside the White House compound was, what the benefit of having a press pool always on call and always at the ready was.
Yeah, I covered the campaign like Major, and we were on a chase plane. We didn't always even chase him. We were sort of often five states away from where he was, with no access to anyone. The best place to cover the Trump campaign, ultimately, at the end, a lot of state, I was either at a Trump rally and you just stayed in in Pennsylvania and just went to every Trump rally in Pennsylvania, or you just parked yourself in the lobby of Trump Tower on these insanely uncomfortable benches for hours on hours, and you just talk to whoever.
Get the taco salad and talk to whoever.
And you know, go to the Starbucks. I mean, that was how you did it. You know, he did interviews occasionally. He'd call you up or whatever. But, you know, and the transition, there was, I'm sure you saw some of that, the fears on our end, the speculation in the press, some juiced by some of the people around the president at the time. You know, we're going to get rid of the press room or move the press, you know, across the street, across the country, into the Atlantic, I don't know. But ultimately, by the time the president, you know, they did their first formal briefing, maybe 3 or 4 days before Inauguration Day at the transition headquarters from a couple blocks from the White House. And it went okay for them. It was not the best move. But almost immediately, the president got to the Oval Office, saw the room. And he's somebody who's obviously a reality television star, understands the media and understands the power of visuals, recognized the power of that office, the power of utilizing that office, that space, and what that can give him. And utilized it more than President Obama, certainly. I mean, if he was at the White House, you know, for four days straight, just taking meetings and discussing things with cabinet members and getting daily briefings and things like that, we would see him maybe once in 4 days. You know, sometimes we'd go almost a whole week without laying eyes on him physically. With this president, that there are occasionally dry spells like that, but more often than not, we are there being called back to the Oval Office, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5 times a day, running back, you know, the staff just like calling over the intercom, like pull to the briefing room doors now, and just like screaming at us because they want us there right now because he wants the visual, and oftentimes he'll take questions. You know, we've gone more than a year now without a formal press conference from the president. That said, if you tally up the number of questions that President Trump has answered in Oval Office sprays and on the steps of Mar-a-Lago and things like that. On the way to the helicopter. He's taken on par probably about where, I have to go to Martha Kumar, a colleague of ours, sort of scholar of these interactions, but it's pretty darn close to where President Obama was at that point. These are not the same questions, and there's a difference in that venue and the nature of those questions, that in that setting, the power that comes from you standing behind a podium and taking questions from the press, and you get a different sort of interaction. Don't get me wrong there. I'm not sort of trying, but there is a change here in the sense that the president values a certain level of interaction with the press. He sees utility in the press we're not beating up on him. There's more access to Donald Trump on a daily basis than there was to Barack Obama. It's a different sort of access. I think that's an important.
It tends to be less substantive. It tends to be less interactive, and it tends, by his design, to be more on his terms.
Absolutely.
The surprise element of when the questions will be allowed.
Who will ask them? You might think you'll get a question, and the aides will tell you, oh, you're getting a question, and then it's, you know, a friendly outlet or something like that.
But even then, I mean, there is the full press corps, which is a couple hundred, 200-300 people, the full sort of regulars who would come in and out on a day-to-day basis. And then there's the pool, which is like 13 or 21, depending if you're on the road or in town. If you're taking questions from the pool, you're taking questions from, at best, 10% of the people you might be taking questions from. So it is, the terms are different, and what you get out of it is different, and yet the frequency is actually much greater.
There's the Obama administration sort of got pilloried by the president, said this is the most transparent administration ever. Yeah. In a way, just to make the argument here, the Trump administration is in some ways the most transparent administration ever. We have never had this window into the most important piece of presidential real estate, which is, you know, the one cubic foot above a president's shoulder, and we know what he's thinking on. You know, if you look at the tweets of the last 72 hours, we know exactly what he's thinking about everything from a shooting to a Russia investigation and indictments to Oprah. We know what he's thinking at all times. And those interactions. So I think that it's important to sort of, you know, from our job to sort of evaluate. There are benefits to that, and there are costs to it, but it's also sort of, to have an open discussion about it, it's important to recognize.
We still don't have any transparency on some of the things that are traditional measuring sticks by which you understand the person who is in power, their tax returns, the comings and goings of who is in the White House, and the issue of continuity to me, because while we do know what the president is thinking or wants us to think he's thinking at any moment within the span of a day or a week, it often changes and then changes back. And so you have the information, but it's hard to know what the information is necessarily worth sometimes.
It sounds like a lot of noise. A lot of noise is going on.
That's a faster way to say that.
But I mean, think about it. It's so much information, and this is what we, the consumers, depend upon, is to make sense out of it. And it's overwhelming amount of work, I'm sure, for all of you, when it's just constant, you know, run here, do this, cover this. And the topics are so diverse on the tweets, it's how to make sense of that and tell the public what is really important here and what isn't.
Social scientists have this concept about confirmation bias, and so I think all of us suffer from a confirmation bias about Trump because he's on Twitter and all the, everything we've said about it, but we have no counterfactual. We have no idea what Bill Clinton would have done with Twitter. Bill Clinton was up till 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. He thought and wanted to communicate directly all the time. I actually, Karen, what do you think? I mean, I think he would have been a rather engaged and frequent Twitter user or social media user, or
absolutely,
someone who was attracted to, driven by the newest technology, the newest ideas. I have a feeling that if this were available to Bill Clinton at the highs and lows of his presidency, he'd have been right out there too.
Oh, I think so, absolutely. He, you guys made the point well that it's not new for a president to go up or down below the press corps. You know, Clinton tried it and succeeded. Arsenio Hall, Larry King Live, right after Jennifer Flowers broke, he did the famous 60 Minutes interview. Like, no questions except the ones I can control about, you know, pain in my marriage and all that stuff. And then after he got elected, he would all of a sudden we're back behind red velvet ropes and far away from him. And I have no doubt he would use it. And I had some notes written, and I wanted, one of them was, we had no Tom Hanks in the Bill Clinton White House. I know Tom Hanks has bought cappuccino makers for the White House briefing room, right? And I thought about it, and I thought, you know what, Hollywood, they probably wouldn't have liked the Clinton White House press corps very much, because Clinton and Hollywood were very tight, of course. And but I think he would have absolutely used it, and he was up. I mean, many times he was up late at night playing solitaire by himself. And so, had he had the phone at his fingertips, yes, no telling what he would have done.
That's Karen Ball, former White House correspondent for the New York Daily News. She's one of four journalists that spoke at The President and the Press on February 19, 2018 at the Truman Presidential Library and Institute in Independence, Missouri. We've also heard from Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, Zeke Miller, White House Correspondent for the Associated Press, and Margaret Talev, White House Correspondent for Bloomberg News. At the time of this event, Talev was the president of the White House Correspondents Association, which held a series of events like this one to promote freedom of the press. Also on this panel, Dr. Betty Winfield, who studies political communication and mass media history. Coming up, the panel takes questions from the audience right after this. From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. Hope you'll join us for Your Ears Only, Audio Reader's annual benefit sale of CDs, vinyl records, and audio equipment. It takes place Friday, September 14th and Saturday, September 15th at the Douglas County Fairgrounds in Lawrence. All proceeds from For Your Ears Only will benefit Audio Reader, a reading service for the blind and visually impaired. Find out more about For Your Ears Only at reader.ku.edu.
Support for KPR comes from Morningstar Care Homes, presenting Dunn's Vista, now open in Baldwin City. Early stage care for Alzheimer's, dementia, and Parkinson's in a real home environment overlooking Vinland Valley. More at MorningstarCareHomes.com.
If you're just joining us, today on KPR presents The President and the Press. The White House Correspondents Association raised a red flag earlier this year about President Trump's frequent attacks on the media. In response, the association launched a series of events across the country to explain and promote the role of a free press in America today. The first of those events was held February 19, 2018, at the Truman Presidential Library and Institute in Independence, Missouri. It featured four journalists that have covered several presidencies and presidential campaigns. On today's panel, Major Garrett of CBS News, Zeke Miller of the Associated Press, Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News, Karen Ball, formerly of the New York Daily News, and Dr. Betty Winfield, who specializes in the history of the mass media. The panel now takes questions from the audience.
I wonder how you get all the policy information ahead. I know you mentioned that sometimes it's hard to do. And how do you find reliable sources? I don't envy Sarah Huckabee Sanders. She's got the most thankless job there, I think. But who are your reliable sources?
Well, for any White House reporter, you cover people in the building, but then you also cover people in the agencies, the interested parties, either organizations. There are a number of environmental groups that sort of get an inkling that things are coming. There was a lot of early warning signs about Bear's Ears and Grand Escalante being reduced in size and scope from the Obama administration. So there are a lot of different ways to find information. And as Zeke and Karen knows, you can't just rely on the briefing. If that's all you do, if your entire day as a White House reporter is built around the briefing, you're doing it 100% wrong. That's really the last place you go to get the best information. You get it from the outside, you bring it in and force them to respond to it. But you bring up a very important point about covering the Trump presidency. Politico actually has a column that they run with some frequency. Five things that Trump did this week you were too busy to pay attention to, or that you might have missed. I mean, all the histrionics, the mania, the tweets, everything else, there are these policy things that keep being moved along. And Politico has actually carved out a space to try to identify these underlying policy developments and keep track of them, even though they were not the headline-grabbing events of the week. And under a different administration that was less manic, they probably would have been, or at least would have gotten some degree more coverage than they do in this current environment. And one of the things I'm trying to focus on my book is that those things that, whether you heard about them or read about them or not, are going to be most lasting from the Trump administration after its first year. Because some things happen that are going to be with us for a good long while. And it is always this very difficult question with Donald Trump. Do you cover the interesting or do you cover the important? And there's a tremendous volume of both. But because he knows, because he's really our first president who was a celebrity first, that's really an important factor. He was a celebrity first on his own right, and he understood celebrity culture, and he understood celebrity culture's interaction with politics. So he comes with a baseline understanding of celebrity-dom and what celebrity can do and how it can project itself before he became a political actor. And so he merges these two worlds in a way that we've really never seen before. Much more a powerful celebrity than Ronald Reagan was. Ronald Reagan had a sense of the art form, but he wasn't a fully formed celebrity. He was known, but not a celebrity. Donald Trump was a celebrity. And he acts and uses his presidency in part because of his instincts as a celebrity. So he knows how to create lots of different areas of interest while he's doing all sorts of other things that are important. And being able to focus on that is a manpower issue, a person power issue for every news organization in Washington, which are mostly smaller than they used to be. 30 years ago, CBS, the company I work for, had a producer in every agency in the federal government, a producer who only covered the EPA, for example, or the Interior Department, for example, or the Agriculture Department, someone who was there every day, interacted with the secretary, the deputy secretary, the undersecretaries, and just compiled information all the time. Did it make air every day? Of course not. But it was part of the institutional knowledge that the network had. We don't have that anymore. It all falls to me and my colleagues at the White House. That's similar to the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, all the news organizations that are smaller in number than they used to be, which goes to one of Zeke's earlier points about that's another advantage this president has. He knows the press corps is smaller and more overworked than ever, and the interesting can be up here, while the important can sometimes get overshadowed. And that's one of the really great, the biggest challenges one of the biggest challenges of this administration.
One other part of your question I think I picked up on, the difficulty in sort of how do you know who to trust and the different sources there. And that's something that I'm sure we all struggle with every day on the White House beat. It's not a new struggle, but an interesting difference between this administration and previous ones. If in the Obama administration, if you got two people to tell you something, you can pretty much bet the bank on it. You know, with very, very, very rare exceptions, if you had three sources, you were gold. In this administration, you can get three people to tell you, we're going to bomb North Korea tomorrow, or we bombed North Korea yesterday. You just haven't heard about it yet. There's an element of where some people aren't in the know. Some people are willfully, trying to manipulate the press, trying to discredit the press, trying to fight internal battles through the press. So they're passing off, negative derogatory information to discredit colleagues or trying to set the reporters up. It's a different environment that we're in. It's not necessarily new, but it's certainly more extreme than we've seen before. Different administrations and political figures have tried this tactic in the past, but it's an interesting, how do we know who to trust? We talk to a lot of people, and then, we use our judgment, and if we aren't confident on it, we sit on it. I mean, all of our, our brains are filled with things that, we're chasing that we can't tell you yet. And, we aren't going to tell you because we can't stand behind it yet. And that's, why you read outlets and you should read outlets you trust and watch outlets you trust. And that's why good journalism matters now, maybe more than ever. But that's what good journalists do. And they don't just publish rumor. They publish facts and that requires being sure of what we report. And that means in this administration talking to, 10 or 15 people before we run with something, sometimes not just two or three.
The only other quick thing I'd add before we take another question is any member of the public can read the Federal Register. You can do it online. You can sign up for alerts. It's really tedious, but it's incredibly, it's like a font of information if you can slog through it. And also that elections have consequences, and the executive branch has a lot of leeway if it doesn't involve a law that Congress has passed that a president has signed that, rules something out, or if it doesn't involve an appropriation that Congress controls. So whether it's judicial nominees or whether it's stuff that falls within executive power, anything from parks related to foreign policy, a sitting president, particularly if the Congress is of the same political persuasion as they are, can do a lot. And many Americans agree with the things that he's doing, just not you. Maybe not some people in this room. Anyway, thank you, great question.
I'd like to say, two things. First of all, I have three teenage daughters, and I think they looked at me with this necktie on as though I had antlers coming out of my ears. And I am wearing this out to honor a reporter named Michael Kelly, who worked for the New York Times on the Clinton campaign, went on to work for also the Atlantic and other organizations. He died in 2003 covering the Iraq War, and he was not an enemy of the people. He was one of the biggest patriots I've ever known. And it's been, I'm somewhat out of the business now. So I'm not criticizing Trump. I still try to stay apolitical, although I am criticizing Trump here. I mean, I think that his trying to sow discord and hatred of the media is so dangerous and so vile. I don't know any, all, there are other reporters who've died on the job too, and I won't list them all. And my problem with some of my friends who, I get that they didn't like Hillary Clinton. I'm not I understand all the reasons why he did not get elected. I never understood the Make America Great Again. It's always been great, and we're still the most powerful country in the world, and everybody wants to come to America. And have we lost some standing on the world stage? Yes, that's what people are saying. I don't think it will take very long for America to recover at all. I think that the United States of America is always going to be the world leader, and whether this is a hiccup or not, I mean, I don't think he does long-term damage to the United States. Maybe I'm just being overly hopeful. Major, what do you think?
Well, that was said at Davos, and that it was said is true. That it is true, I'm not sure about. I mean, I still think the United States is an enormously influential player in the world, economically and militarily for sure. And I can tell you, having traveled in Europe with President Trump and watching him speak to NATO leaders, and when he was in Saudi Arabia, changed the overall orientation of that part of the world toward Iran and toward Israel, that's still an aspect of American influence. And it is changing under President Trump, understandably. The world is reacting to him in different ways. But that doesn't by itself diminish America's standing in the world. Now, when that person in Davos said, we don't pay attention to what he says, there are plenty of Republicans in Congress who say exactly the same thing. They say, they've said this out loud, I'm not speaking out of school. They say, we don't care what he says, especially on Twitter, we only care what he does. And what he says on Twitter and what he does are oftentimes two different things. So it's not as if European politicians are the only ones reacting this way. Donald Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, has told me to my face, I don't deal with the president on Twitter. I deal with the president everything up and to Twitter. Okay? I manage the flow of information to the president, and what he tweets is his business. My job as chief of staff is to give him information, let him make decisions, implement the decisions he's made. My job is not to run his Twitter account. Okay? So even the chief of staff of the president of the United States doesn't necessarily pay attention or live or die by what the president says. That doesn't make him any less powerful.
It may or may not be the right course for John T. Kelly to be taking.
It may or may not be.
Throw that out there. That's a possibility.
but that approach to the president and what he says is not unique in its form of expression in Davos. It's commonly found on Capitol Hill. You can even find those who believe it and operationally live by it, who work directly beneath the president of the United States. To your larger question about American preeminence, Chinese President Xi knows America is still a very powerful country. When the president was in Mar-a-Lago with his summit with President Xi, during the middle of dinner, he said, excuse me, I need to stand up and go out here for a few minutes. Came back and said, by the way, I just had a press briefing. We've just launched 59 Tomahawk missiles into Syria. Chinese can't do that. America is the only country that can, on behalf of a established moral principle or predicate, chemical weapons, take action like that and then sit down with the Chinese and say, I'm sorry, I had to just leave and take this massive military action that sort of explains a moral proposition for the entire world. China can't and doesn't do that, right? That's still a big difference between however economically powerful, however militarily powerful or ambitious China is, it's still not the United States in that sense.
But Betty, America wasn't like born able to do that, right? I mean, World War II had a little something to do.
Well, the Marshall Plan, certainly that Truman pushed, made us extremely popular post-World War II. But I don't know how many, do you all travel a lot outside the US? Yes. And when the taxi driver brings up your president, when the clerk at the hotel, when anyone you ask, it's not positive right now. I'm telling you, as someone who went to four countries this past year, it's not positive. So I don't know whether that means something in a big picture. It's not a statistic. It's not a public opinion poll. But when they say something like that, and that's how Roosevelt collected information in the country before we had public opinion polls that were refined, you do pay attention to it. You do listen to it. I'm not sure we're really very popular right now in a lot of countries. Not every country, obviously. But a lot of countries.
Just one small historical note on that, because I've been doing some research on this. So we all remember Ronald Reagan at the Brandenburg Gate, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. What we may not remember is the day before that, 500,000 people protested in the streets of Berlin. Half of the city was shut down. They were not protesting on behalf of Ronald Reagan in the United States of America. They were vociferously protesting against Reagan, calling him a warmonger and a threat to European peace. The day before, one of the most historic statements President Reagan ever uttered, a maybe rhetorical turning point of the Cold War, 500,000 people were screaming their lungs out about how America was ruining Europe and a threat to world peace. That's just a contextual fact about how sometimes the American presidency carries with it burdens that are larger than what may be reflected in the public attitudes of any particular country at any particular given time.
I would just say that I think that one of the kind of pivots that this question goes to, and you know your own question, you said you don't know if we'd be able to answer it because history is the judge of this, is the question of U.S. engagement, right, on issues, on global issues, whether it's global trade, the global economy, involvement in security issues,
migration,
climate, right,
immigration.
That if the U.S. pulls back or is a disruptor or says we're not doing this anymore, you guys do it. Does that create space for other countries to step in and then take a more eminent role? That might be what you're asking. So I think it's very early. I know no one will believe this, but it's actually only 13 months into this presidency. And so we'll come back in 3 years and do this again, and we can bring it up again.
My name's Tom Jumps. I used to be a journalist, and I taught journalism in high school. My question is on a very personal basis. I would have a very difficult time at this point in being objective in relationship to Donald Trump. How do you do that in your daily reporting of his personality and of his policies?
Do you mean you would have a difficult job because of his public attitude toward the press or because of everything? I mean,
particularly toward the press, but in everything in general.
I think that's an important question. And gets to sort of the purpose of one of the reasons why we're doing this panel to begin with. Yeah. I don't mind being attacked. I don't mind being criticized. It's part of the job. There's a line, and there's a line this president has crossed multiple times. That this, you know, in violating the norms of the way the president talks about all sorts of things, and the way the president talks about the media and trying to destabilize the institution of the American of the American press. But at the same time, I'm not looking for an easy ride. I don't mind, it's our jobs, I think, to take it in stride and be professional and answer occasionally unprofessional comments with the utmost professionalism. And I think that's what we all try to do every single day. You look around the briefing room, you look at the coverage coming out of this White House, you're seeing some of the best political journalism, in some cases the best political journalism ever, sort of in-depth understanding of what the administration is doing in real time. Putting it in context, historical context, in real time, that I think we get paid all the time to sort of set aside our emotional responses if we it's our job, and when our professionalism is under attack, to be as professional, to be even more professional in the face of that. I think that's the way I think I certainly look at it.
I think it's fair to say I have a unique perspective on that question. in this one sense, and I'm probably going where you're not exactly expecting me to go. It was mentioned when I was introduced that I was the senior White House correspondent for Fox News. Some of you may remember the newly christened Obama administration in 2009 described Fox News as a propaganda arm of the Republican Party and therefore an illegitimate news organization, and these are their words, not mine, that they were at war with. Yes, the President of the United States and everyone who worked beneath him, President Obama, saying they were at war with the journalistic organization, Fox News. Now, you may agree or disagree with what either the President said or what Fox News represented, but I was the senior editorial representative of that network. I'm the same journalist now as I was then. But I was, because I was the most visible correspondent for that network, indicted by implication from everything the White House said. So I have an experience with not one but two administrations telling me to my face that I'm an illegitimate reporter who should not be believed and am fundamentally dishonest and am biased by my very nature. Not one but two administrations. So I've lived through this. And I would just say the generalized topic of hostility to the press is a lot more au courant now than it was in 2009, when many of my colleagues looked at me and said, well, good luck.
I never said that.
You're doing okay, Mage. All right, fine. We're heading out the door, but you keep struggling there.
Let the record reflect that Margaret, on multiple occasions, passed questions in the Obama
my
briefing
time
room.
To Fox a couple times.
So no. And it was. I'm just saying that it was an issue, but not an issue. Okay, I did get sympathetic treatment from my White House colleagues, but it wasn't a topic. It wasn't like, oh my God, what's happening? There wasn't that kind of reaction at all. So they're like, well, Obama's at war, okay. And when that war, their word again, not mine, ended, when President Obama gave me an interview along with every other network correspondent, and of all places, Beijing, the AP wrote about it out of New York with my name in the lead. Major Garrett, because an interview with President Obama, war over. And Karen and Zeke will understand this. I thought I had to die to get my name in the AP lead. So, to Zeke's point, and the most important word I think that Margaret spoke tonight was opportunity. Look, everyone is paying very close attention to this presidency and its interaction with the news media. It is our time to be the best we've ever been, and to be as level-headed as we've ever been, and to be not as not emotional as we've ever been. We don't have the luxury of emotion. We only have the obligation to carry out the First Amendment under all of its privileges and consistent with all of its responsibilities. And that's all I try to do every single day.
I would say a couple of things. One is that no president is ever your friend. And as both of these gentlemen, my colleagues have said, you know, you don't do your job to be liked or validated by the president. And you know you're doing your job well if they get really angry with you, but they can't really say why. So that's like a good sign. I do think that what's different, what President Obama would do is President Obama would publicly speak about the importance of a robust free press and democracy. And when he'd go to other countries, he would always show that side, partly because he believed it, partly because he knows that that empowers him and also sets an example for stability in the world. We could be at home at the White House, and they could be doing all the stuff White Houses do, leak stuff to friendly people, punish people who stuck it to them, circle the wagons, all that kind of stuff. But the public message was always, well, you know, these guys sometimes are a little tough on me, but what they do is important. And that's not what President Trump does. And what President Trump does objectively is much more destructive to the fabric of society, the fabric of a democracy, the ability for the public to trust facts. And being able to trust facts is incredibly important and how society works. But having said that, I think it's a mistake for any journalist to try to judge which presidents were on their side and which were not. No president is on journalist's side. Every president is weighing their instincts about how best to govern and lead and what's best for the country against their instincts about themselves, about ego, about political power, about how history remembers them, about how to get stuff done. And our job is to help explain to people what's really going on, when anyone is in charge, why they do the things they do and what the implications are. Sometimes it feels easier than other times, but when it starts feeling too easy, you're probably making a mistake. Right now it feels really hard, so we're all trying to do the best job we can, I think.
Margaret Taleb is White House correspondent for Bloomberg News and is past president of the White House Correspondents Association. We've also heard from White House correspondents Major Garrett, Zeke Miller, and Karen Ball, along with media historian Dr. Betty Winfield. They spoke on the presidency and the press at the Truman Presidential Library on February 19, 2018. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.